from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts lawmakers quietly vote to delay part of the new recreational marijuana law.
I think that everybody wants to get through this unusual, awkward period that we're in, where it's legal to possess marijuana and use marijuana, but it's not legal to sell it.
Also today, we take stock of the year in local politics.
Yes, it's a wake-up call, and we need to look, frankly, at the communities where Donald Trump won.
Plus, the year in science and health. And we talk with the author and the subject of a book about a man who's out on parole after he was sent to prison for murder at age 16.
An officer came into the cell, and I thought he was going to tell me my mother was there and I could leave. And he said, "I'm sorry to inform you, but the kid that you stabbed has died."
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Some people are crying foul today after a surprise vote by just a handful of Massachusetts lawmakers this morning. The legislators decided to delay the time frame by which stores can sell marijuana for recreational use. That was a part of the ballot question that voters approved last month. Senate President Stan Rosenberg says today's action still supports voters' wishes, but he says lawmakers need time to deal with the logistics.
The people voted in principle. We're going to obey that principle. We're going to support their will. What we're doing is working on the details.
Joining us to talk further about this is Katie Lannon, a reporter for the State House News Service. Katie, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you were watching this vote in the House today. What happened?
Yeah, I was in the House today, and this bill originated first elsewhere in the building. It came out of the Senate first, and it passed quickly there without much discussion. Senate President Rosenberg introduced it, said that it would delay the implementation of the, you know, the retail licensing portion of the law by 6 months. Then it came over to the Senate, or rather from the Senate to the House, where there were about four lawmakers present. They quickly agreed with no discussion, and, you know, with two more procedural votes, the bill was sent to Governor Baker's desk, and now it's in front of him for his review.
So no opposition expressed or anything like that?
No, there was no opposition, no discussion, just a quick, you know, the whole process took about 2 hours from its introduction to its passage.
Hmm. Now, Senator Rosenberg had indicated that something like this might happen, that legislation regarding recreational marijuana use and tweaking the new law might take place in informal session. How unusual do you think it is that four people would be present when something like this comes forward?
You know, it's actually not that unusual for there to be only three or four representatives or senators in an informal session, in contrast to a full formal session, which would usually have the full 40 senators and 160 representatives in the chamber. These informal sessions are usually sparsely attended. There's often one Republican and one Democrat, and you usually see kind of uncontroversial bills moving through, liquor licenses, local bills, things like that.
So maybe not unusual in terms of how well or not well attended this session may have been, but unusual in the fact that this is something significant that potentially affects a large number of people.
Yeah, I think that's a fair characterization, although, you know, there was a lot of agreement in the legislature that there might need to be delays. So in that regard, it was something that there wasn't a lot of controversy around within the legislature itself, how the advocates and the critics of the law or supporters of the law might react to it is a different story.
And what it means essentially is recreational marijuana use is still legal in Massachusetts. There's nothing changed there. The only thing that changes is when stores can begin selling it. Is that right?
Right. A bulk of the law took effect on December 15th, and that's the possession, the home grow, provisions, the fact that you can give marijuana as a gift, none of that changes what this action today, if the bill is signed into law by Governor Baker, will do is push back the retail licensing by 6 months. It'll give Treasurer Goldberg another 6 months to appoint members of the Cannabis Control Commission, and it'll give that commission another 6 months to formulate and put out its regulations.
Okay. Katie Lannon, reporter for State House News Service, I want to say thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
I'm also told now that State Senator Jason Lewis is on the line. He amended this bill to allow for this vote today, delaying this sale of recreational marijuana in Massachusetts. Senator, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Deb. My pleasure.
So explain very briefly, if you would, what your amendment is doing so folks aren't confused about thinking that as of December 15th, recreational marijuana was legal, but now something happened on December 28th and we don't know where that stands. Where does it stand?
So to be clear, the legislature intends to, you know, go forward and fully respect the will of the voters. And marijuana, recreational marijuana use in Massachusetts, you know, will be legal for use, for possession, purchase, and sale. What we've done with this legislation today, which is now headed to Governor Baker's desk, is simply to add a little bit more time for the creation of a regulatory structure to oversee the new commercial marijuana industry. So the possession and consumption of limited amounts of marijuana and also limited home growing of marijuana, which became legal on December 15th, there's been no change to that whatsoever. So all we're talking about here is the time frame and the steps that we will have to go through to create a regulatory structure and allow for a whole new industry to, you know, to be created in Massachusetts to sell marijuana.
But stores would not then open in January of 2018 as expected. It would be really the first stores opening 6 months after that. So you've effectively delayed the opening of when stores might be able to sell marijuana. Is that right?
Possibly. I mean, those dates, which were written in the original ballot question that passed on November 8th, and the updated dates, which are would be in the law we passed today, those are the dates, the latest time at which that action needs to take place. It's certainly the intention of the legislature, and I know Governor Baker, and I know Treasurer Goldberg, and others, to move as quickly and as efficiently as we can to to craft the legislation that's needed and the regulations that are needed to implement the law. So we're going to move forward as quickly as we can. And, you know, that means hopefully that we will be able to, if anything, do things sooner than those dates.
Some have questioned why it was done the way it was done today with so few lawmakers present during an informal session. Why do it this way and raise people's eyebrows?
Well, we really didn't have a choice. The ballot question passed on November 8th, and this is a time of year when the legislature is not meeting in what are known as formal sessions. So we would be meeting just in informal sessions. If the legislature didn't act before the end of the year, we would have had to wait until potentially well into next year by the time the new legislature convenes and is sworn in, by the time committees are set up. That could have delayed this by several months, and we didn't want to risk delaying this process any more than we have to, because we do want to move forward as quickly as possible to implement the new law. So that's why we felt it was important that we act actually before the end of this year and not push this off into next year.
All right. Senator Jason Lewis, who amended this bill that essentially delays the start of the sale of recreational marijuana in stores in Massachusetts, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
We want to talk more about this and about local politics in general as we continue our conversations looking back on 2016. So we're joined in studio right now by Peter Ubertasio. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Stonehill College. Welcome back to the program, Peter, and I hope I didn't say your name wrong.
Thanks for having me.
First, your reaction to this vote today by Massachusetts lawmakers delaying some parts of the new law allowing for recreational marijuana use.
Sure. I think Katie Lannon laid it out perfectly, and Senator Lewis defended it in a very I think the straightforward way, the legislature is in informal session right now. There's not a lot you can do about that. And to do it now meant that it wouldn't even further delay the opening of retail marijuana shops. And we're talking about 6 months, not, you know, say 6 years or even 12 months. So I don't think one reason you would raise something like this in informal session is because you have to, given timeline, but also because it's probably, as Katie pointed out, very non-controversial among legislators and local officials, who I'm sure are giving their legislators an earful.
Right. But we've seen what happened with medical marijuana, and certainly that's been delayed over and over again. So I think some folks have already raised the question: what does this mean, and how could this also could those similar delays? Are we seeing a repeat of that with recreational marijuana?
Sure, and that's entirely possible as well. So mm-hmm. I think in order to put together a responsible regulatory regime for marijuana, another 6 months is probably not asking a lot, and it's probably not beyond the bounds of realistically what you would need to do. But we do know that during that extra time, there will probably continue to be a push to delay even further. So I think that's something that proponents of this initiative will need to be quite vigilant with.
Well, let's move on to politics more broadly. Big news this year, as we're looking back in politics in the year of 2016. The big news, of course, presidential election and how Donald Trump's election played out here in Massachusetts. Let's start with Governor Charlie Baker. He refused to cast a ballot for president in this election. What do you think that has done to his popularity? Anything?
Not really. I don't think it's hurt him at all. I think Republican governors in Massachusetts in particular are in a very good place when they can occupy a middle ground between what's going on with their national party, which is unpopular in this state, and the left, you know, the Democrats here in Massachusetts. So I think it might hurt him at the margins among Republican primary voters. Donald Trump did really well here in the Massachusetts presidential primary. I'm not sure that's going to translate to much in terms of a movement to deny Charlie Baker nomination by Republicans. There may be more folks on the right who are willing to come out against him as a result of that, but I don't think enough that it will hurt him. It might sting a little bit, but nothing to deny him renomination.
You know, we spoke with Kristen Hughes, head of the Republican Party in Massachusetts, on our show after the election, and she voted for Trump, and she said this about the state of Massachusetts Republicans. Let's listen.
I think you can be a supporter of Trump, of the president, and also be a supporter of a more moderate stream of Republicanism that we represent really here in Massachusetts.
Peter, your take on that, on the state of Republicans in Massachusetts. And you know, they are more moderate, certainly, than a lot of Republicans that we see nationally.
They are. They appeal, folks like Charlie Baker appeal to a lot of Democrats and a lot of independent voters. The core of the Republican Party here has a sufficient number of moderates, but it does have some very far-right members of their party who are Trump supporters. I hazard to say conservative because I don't think that Trump is really quite conservative, a bit radical. I think that needle is going to be difficult to thread, trying to maintain support both for the president and for a Republican figure like Charlie Baker. I think that she is right, that a lot of folks are going to be able to do that with no problem. But I think as things unfold in Washington, that may become more and more untenable.
Let's move on to some of the notable moments for Governor Baker in 2016. Governing Magazine reported that his approval ratings have consistently been in the 70% range. How is he doing at the end of 2016, particularly after the failures of those two big ballot questions? Baker opposed recreational marijuana use, question 4, and he also opposed question 2, which was the expansion of charter schools. He put a lot of political capital, particularly into question 2, the charter school question. And now that the voters have contradicted him on both of those questions, what do you think that does? Anyone?
It hurts. I think that it demonstrates that there are limits and that while folks may like you, they're not always willing to listen to you. The marijuana initiative was a pox on everyone's house. All major policymakers in the state came out against it, and voters turned a deaf ear to their pleas. Mm. Charter school is a little bit different because Baker really put his political popularity on the line and voters were not having it. I'm not sure that ultimately hurts his popularity. I think that there's still generally a lot of support for charter schools in Massachusetts. It really was a question, I think, of financing moving forward and budgeting properly for them. There were plenty of folks who are in favor of charter schools who also oppose the initiative because they'd like to see the funding mechanism worked out. So I'm not sure that it hurts. I think it really just demonstrates that there are appropriately limits to what a leader can get the people to do. I think he goes into 2017 retaining a lot of popularity.
Let's talk about Attorney General Maura Healey. She's been in the news quite a bit this year, and she's made some big moves this year. First on gun legislation. In July, Healey cracked down on the sale of so-called copycat assault weapons, redefining certain kinds of guns as prohibited assault weapons in Massachusetts. And we spoke with her here on Radio Boston in July just after that, and she joined us from the Democratic National Convention. Let's listen.
I viewed it as my obligation, frankly, after Orlando, to take a look at what was happening with respect to our own state assault weapons ban. And so we wanted to be clear and take action and issue this directive, putting gun dealers and manufacturers on notice that our office is going to enforce the law so that we have the full protection of the law here in this state, at least.
Yeah, Peter, I'm wondering what you think of that move on the part of Attorney General Healey. How do you think that affects things, you know, for her here and nationally?
I think it helps her politically here. I think in the aftermath of all the shootings, and if there's one thing we know about American cultures, there will be more of these. We're always looking for political leaders to do something. Here you have a political leader who did something, even though those tragedies have not recently struck in Massachusetts. And so I think that, you know, trying to find a way to respect the Second Amendment rights, which are in the Constitution, the federal Constitution, but also adhering to your state laws and going after copycat guns is probably politically a positive for her, both within the state and I think within national Democratic Party circles.
What do you think about her political star, though, Maura Healey's? Does she have aspirations beyond Attorney General, it would seem, and what might those be?
Sure. I think that have aspirations all of the time. And so I think the Attorney General probably does have aspirations beyond the AG's office. Certainly, she's discussed often as a possible gubernatorial candidate. Mm-hmm. It's all about timing. It's very hard to unseat an incumbent governor, and an incumbent governor has not been denied reelection in a general election contest since 1974. So it's not easily done. Attorneys general in Massachusetts always aspire to something else, and they almost always come up short.
Right?
So there are lots of reasons for that, and some of them are specific to the individual races. But she retains a lot of star power in Democratic Party circles here in Massachusetts, and I think whether it is a future congressional run, you know, at some point there will be some Senate seats open, and we expect members of Congress will run for those, and there'll be congressional seats open. So she's young, she's popular, and she's got, I think, quite a significant future in Democratic Party politics. She should stay in the Attorney General's office for quite some time, that would be my guess, until she thinks the time is right to maybe look at the governor's race or a Senate race or a congressional race.
Hmm. Let's talk about Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Two members of his administration were charged with trying to force the Boston Music Festival to hire union workers. How do you think this has affected Marty Walsh?
You know, it's such an interesting indictment because they're not accused of doing anything to personally enrich themselves. So it's an unusual case of that the U.S. attorney has made against these two officials. I'm not sure it has hurt Marty Walsh. I think he's a generally very well-liked mayor. I think a lot of the deep divisions that occurred in Boston politics decades ago They haven't evaporated. They're still there, but they're just so less pronounced than they used to be. And he's well regarded among his base, in the neighborhoods, among the business community, in the high tech community. I think these indictments hurt because it just knowing that your aides have been indicted and it hasn't happened in a long time in Boston. I think that hurts, but I'm not sure that it's inflicted any serious damage in terms of his reelection attempt.
All right. Peter Ubertasio, Associate Professor of Political Science at Stonehill College. He's been helping us remember the past year in local politics. Peter, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Zika CRISPR, gravitational waves, atypical words that were heard quite a bit in 2016, words that we're going to talk about again as we look back on the year in science and medicine. Joining us is Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you, Deb.
So let's start with one of the big stories of the year, which scientists say proves that Albert Einstein was right. Gravitational waves do exist.
Right. So 100 years after he predicted them, Einstein was gloriously proven right in February. His theory of general relativity predicted that when anything with mass accelerates, it should create a kind of a wave in the fabric of space-time, sort of like a rock thrown into a pond, creating ripples on the water. And instruments here on Earth were able to detect the collision of two black holes that happened more than a billion years ago. The collision contorted space-time and sent like a really big ripple outward. And scientists at LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, announced in February that they were able to detect them.
And MIT physicists were involved.
Yes, from our provincial point of view, they were. And here on Radio Boston, we heard from MIT professor Nergis Mavalvala. She's a professor of astrophysics at MIT, and she's a member of the LIGO team that discovered the waves. She explained why it's taken so long to detect these waves.
It's taken 100 years because it was really hard to do. The technologies just weren't available until recently, and now they're here, and this is just the start. This is just the first ripple we've been able to detect. These detectors are going to get better, and we're just going to listen to more and more music from the universe.
So music from the universe, you gotta love it. And a great many people expect that someone's gonna win the Nobel Prize for this, or multiple people.
Okay, so from LIGO to another acronym, CRISPR. I think that this was the year, at least for me anyway, I started hearing a lot more about CRISPR.
Yeah, well, it's sizzling hot. And to anybody who hasn't been hearing about it, I'd say CRISPR is now a word it's probably worth knowing, an acronym. It stands for, okay, here's another fast reeling off.
You like
go.
This, I think.
Yes, I do. Clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats, CRISPR. And it refers to a pattern of DNA. But what it's really about is it's an incredibly powerful tool for editing genes. It's been sweeping labs around the world, and it's being used in everything from agriculture, like for engineering better crops, to medicine, like trying to cure genetic diseases, HIV, and more.
And CRISPR has been in the news recently because of a big fight over patents.
Right. So the fight is between the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard here on the East Coast and UC or University of California, Berkeley, out on the West Coast. Eric Lander, the director of the Broad Institute, spoke a bit about CRISPR here on Radio Boston in April. And he points out that this new CRISPR technology is based on a trick that bacteria have been using on their own for about a billion years to defend themselves against viruses. He says CRISPR lets them grab a little piece of DNA from the virus and use it kind of like a little note to self. They stuff it into their own set of DNA.
And that becomes a little library of reminders. And they're constantly copying those reminders onto the molecular equivalent of little yellow sticky notes. And whatever any piece of DNA is found in the cell, it compares it to the sticky note. It actually matches it up as DNA and RNA and says, oh, if this matched something on my sticky note of bad things, I'm going to cut it.
So we got music of the universe, we got DNA sticky notes, yes. And with CRISPR, though, of course, now humans are figuring out how to use it in potentially very valuable new ways. And so the patent fight over who gets credit for these new applications has very high stakes. Earlier this month, the two sides presented their oral arguments before a patent court outside D.C., Washington, D.C. And the impression was that the judges grilled the Californian side a little more. But that's kind of like trying to read the tea leaves from the Supreme Court. Like, you can't really know. Mm. Mm-hmm.
So in the coming year, though, we can expect some sort of resolution in what people have been calling what the biggest biotech battle in memory.
I know. Yes, it's the Fraser versus Ali fight. We can expect a decision, but probably not a resolution, because these patent fights can drag on for a long time, sometimes even decades.
So more immediately then, just last week, there was some very good news about a vaccine against the Ebola virus.
Yes, very good news indeed. Last Thursday, scientists announced major success with a vaccine against Ebola. Ebola. They're calling it the first effective vaccine since the virus was discovered 40 years ago.
So impressive progress.
Yeah, and also there's been really impressive progress on malaria, which is, of course, a huge killer in Africa. And it's come not from a vaccine, but just from these sort of practical efforts to fight mosquitoes, get people to sleep under bed nets. It's now estimated that since the year 2000, deaths from malaria have dropped from about 800,000 a year to about 400,000 a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, this year did not bring good news about the Zika virus, where there were confirmed cases in Florida and Texas. Pregnant women were warned about traveling to some neighborhoods in Miami. And of course, the news from Latin America that babies born with microcephaly, more than 2,000 babies confirmed in Brazil.
Right. So, and you know, it's so problematic. It's so new. It was really arguably the biggest health news story of the year. And even the extent of the problem is still not clear. Like, the latest research suggests many babies whose mothers had Zika during pregnancy might have brain problems that are less obvious than microcephaly. But there is progress being made on developing a vaccine. In fact, there are several promising candidate vaccines that are starting to be tested in humans. Dr. Dan Baruch of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center is one of the people at the forefront here. But his research is in lab animals, and he says it's hard to predict when we'll actually have a vaccine for humans that we know is safe and effective.
I can't give a date as to when a vaccine might be available for the general public, but I do think that our current data raise substantial optimism that the development of a vaccine might be possible and therefore accelerate the process of vaccine development.
And from a local point of view, Carrie, I suppose the positive side is that the mosquitoes that carry Zika don't reach Massachusetts.
Yes. Again, from our provincial point of view, that's something I'm very grateful for, although it's still an issue here. Our hospitals and doctors do see cases of it.
So let's talk about some medical advances that were accomplished in this past year.
Okay. So if you listen to On Point today, there's a whole hour on the new frontiers in transplants.
Right. Faces, hands, arms, maybe even a head soon.
Yes. Not here, though.
No, but this year also saw the first uterus transplant, although that ultimately failed because of an infection.
Right. And so big Boston hospitals are among those at the forefront of the transplant world. And in May, a Massachusetts General Hospital team performed the nation's first penis transplant. Tom Manning is the Halifax, Massachusetts man who got the surgery. He'd lost most of his penis to cancer, and he was really open about the operation.
You know, I'm not going to walk around feeling ashamed or anything for nothing. Sometimes bad things in your life happen, and you can go run and hide, or you can face them. And if you want a success story, you have to at least take the chance.
And the hope is that full function will be restored, even sexually. And I know the concept is maybe cringeworthy, but this really could be an important advance, especially for war veterans. And Deb, now I'd like to turn the tables for a moment and ask you about possibly the scariest story in American health and medicine today, this year, the opioid epidemic. So you've been covering that. How would you say it's looking?
Well, I would say the numbers, Carrie, don't look good. Numbers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show that nationally more than 52,000 people died from a drug overdose in 2015. About 63% of those deaths involved a prescription or illicit opioid. And in Massachusetts, the latest numbers suggest that on average, 5 people died every day from an overdose this past year. Surprisingly, that does not put Massachusetts among the states with the 5 highest death rates. But Massachusetts is considered to be among the states that had a significant increase in opioid overdose deaths from 2014 to 2015. And as we talked about earlier in the show, there is a new state law designed to help with the opioid epidemic.
So it's so striking. We're normally out front on health issues, but on this one, we're definitely not. Let's hope the new law makes a difference.
Well, Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Every year in the U.S. criminal justice system, nearly a quarter of a million young people are imprisoned. Most of them will be released at some point, even if they're charged with murder. That's what happened to Carter Kane Reed. In 1993, when Reed was 16 years old, he was charged with killing another teenager, Jason Robinson, inside Dartmouth High School. After decades in prison, he reached out to professor, author, and activist Jean Trounstein, and they began writing to each other. Earlier this year, she wrote his story in the book Boy with a Knife, a story of murder, remorse, and a prisoner's fight for justice. Reed was released on parole more than 3 years ago, and he now works and lives in central Massachusetts. When he and Trounstein came to our studios in April, I started by asking him what life was like in prison.
The thing about prison is, abnormal as those circumstances are, being confined against your will and being having all your freedoms stripped from you, all of the things that you desire, everything and everyone that you love, having all of that taken away, that's something that most people can't relate to. But in another sense, prison is also, it's like everyday life. You have everyday human interactions with other individuals, be they fellow prisoners, the administration, the correctional officers, the volunteers who come in to teach rehabilitative programs. Those interactions are just as human and just as important as the interactions people have in society, with the exception, and what I think has been most beneficial to my development, is they're very concentrated. Those experiences are intensified or magnified by the circumstances because you're in such close confinement constantly. And I think that leads, if you're open to it, it leads to some revelations you may not have had an opportunity to have in society.
When many people think of being incarcerated, they're very frightened by what certainly in the media has been portrayed as a very harsh environment, very cruel environment, and not just by other folks who may be incarcerated, but by some of the folks running the facilities. I mean, is that a TV experience or is that reality?
One of the ironies kind of the situation is that prisons are definitely a microcosm of society with that kind of magnification factor. So if you think of maybe the violence, the attitudes, the hostility, all the things that exist in society, and maybe you multiply that by 10, not because the people are more aggressive, but because circumstances and conditions of confinement kind of just magnify that on their own. You put people in much closer confinement. People don't have an ability to walk away and count to 10 when they're locked inside a 6x9 cell with each other 23 out of 24 hours a day.
Let's talk about how you got there in the first place. It was 1993. What happened?
You know,
which I'm sure you've probably thought about, like, what, maybe every day since then.
This is something that I talk about openly and readily, and I've talked about it hundreds, perhaps even thousands of times. And yeah, it's extremely difficult for me to talk about it for a number of reasons. But one of the most difficult things that I have trouble with is talking about it succinctly, because it's not that I ever want to minimize or justify or explain away anything that happened. I never want to offer any excuses for what happened. But I have this, always have this desire to kind of to give this backstory that some people may feel like is, you know, an excuse in a sense. And for me, the way that I see it is, I didn't come to that point in my life with a blank slate. There were 16 years of life behind me that led me to that point. And how could I talk about that one point in time without at least addressing some of the things that took place in those 16 years? But I do always try to preface what I say with, it's not meant in any way to mitigate my actions, to diminish the harm or the suffering that I inflict.
I'm sorry.
Because those things are very real to me. And it's important to me that people understand that I am aware of that and work hard every day to make amends for the things that I've done.
So essentially, in April of 1993, you were basically, your dad had been sent to prison. You were in a very chaotic home life. Your grades were slipping. You had decided to shut down, kind of emotionally, and you and your friend Gator and Nigel go back to Dartmouth High after an initial confrontation where Nigel is beaten up by some kids there, and you decide to go back. You have a pipe, a bat, and a billy club, and mm-hmm. you go into school, and some teachers are looking for you because they see you come back into the school. They know what happened. You guys run into a classroom, mm-hmm. and you see one of the kids that had hurt Nigel earlier, mm-hmm. and then what happens from there?
So Gator exchanged words, basically called out the student for being involved in the earlier altercation. They began arguing for a split second, and then Gator immediately headed toward the young man who was in the back of the classroom at the time. And at that point, the teachers who had grabbed me in the hall, they saw what was going on and immediately pushed me into the room, told me don't move, stay there, and went after Gator. By this point, maybe 5 seconds into this whole situation, the class had already kind of erupted into chaos and turmoil. Gator was chasing this kid, who in turn was being chased by several teachers now at this point. Desks were being tossed around. There was a lot of commotion. And the teachers managed to get to Gator probably within a couple of seconds and tackle him to the floor. Meanwhile, I was standing just inside the doorway, and the entire time I was watching this happen, my mind was racing. I was panicking. The teachers who had grabbed me had taken the pipe away from me, and I had this kind of overwhelming thought that I have to do something, that, you know, we had let things get out of hand, and that it was now my responsibility to send these kids a message. The kid that Gator was chasing circled around the back of the room and was standing a few feet away from me, and I decided that there was no way out for me except to do something. And it wasn't really a clear thought process. The wheels in my mind were spinning pretty rapidly, and so I decided that I had a solution. And so I walked a few feet toward this young man, and I took a knife from my pocket that I had carried probably for 4 or 5 years, and I stabbed him one time in the stomach. And I tried to walk away like nothing happened, and in that split second I was experiencing a horrible conflicting emotion. On the one hand, I felt like at that age, and again, I don't mean in any way to diminish the outcome of what happened or my actual actions, but on the one hand, I thought I had done this brave and noble thing, that I had done this righteous thing by standing up for my friends. And on the other hand, I was, you know, terrified. I had never really been in any kind of trouble. I had never really been in any kind of direct violent situation like that. I was immediately taken into custody, and I was definitely nervous, because I had no idea what the process I was involved in was and what was going to happen. And, you know, the police started talking about, you know, potential charges, and they were talking about attempted murder, and in my head I was thinking, you know, this is crazy, and there was attempted murder, and that's outlandish, and how can you even say something like that? And
you just thought you were going to hurt this boy, Jason Robinson.
In my mind at that time, I couldn't even connect the two things together, my physical action of stabbing someone and the physical outcome of what that would be. And it may seem, you know, crazy to think that, but I remember, you know, later on when the police were asking me, like, what did you think was going to happen? And I remember not being able to wrap my head around that. And it's like, I never got to that point. I never got to thinking about that. And so they brought me to the police station when I was told I had to wait until my mother came. And again, I was thinking I would certainly be in some kind of trouble, but I didn't think it was anything that significant. An officer came into the cell, and I thought he was going to tell me my mother was there and I could leave. And he said, "I'm sorry to inform you, but the kid that you stabbed has died." And I wish I could say, in that very instant, I was overcome with remorse and sadness and sorrow for him and his family. But I was a self-absorbed, selfish 16-year-old boy, and my first thought was, I'm in so much trouble.
You know, you have a stable job now. You're a homeowner. You were able to go to school. Some folks might say, you know, Jason Robinson's life was taken away and you're able to live a life. What do you say to them?
That's something that I've struggled with mightily throughout my incarceration, the prospect that I would get to go home someday, and Jason wouldn't. And for me, I don't know that there'll ever be a day when I can see things objectively enough to really assess the situation, but the kind of subjective analysis I use is that, you know, the scales of justice, they're never going to be righted. There's a life that was lost that unfortunately no efforts, no matter how Herculean on my part, can ever restore. I can never give back that life, although I would gladly do everything in my power to do that. I can never heal the hurt and loss and brokenness that his family has suffered. I just can't do that. But I have a family of my own who also suffered, who are also victims in this tragedy, and I owe it to them to make the most of everything I have in my life. I owe it to my community. I owe it to society as a whole. And I don't know what my future holds. I don't expect that someday I'm going to change the world, but I know that on a daily basis, I do everything in my power to live a life that is beneficial to all of those with whom my life intersects. And so that's the only thing that I can do. Keeping me in prison doesn't benefit anyone. And that's not coming from some selfish perspective of I enjoy my freedom. I'm a human being. Of course, I enjoy my freedom and try to make the most of it. But my perspective, I try again to always maintain this idea, this focus on doing something productive with my life.
So it sounds essentially like, Carter, your timing here really was not great. I mean, you were accused at a time when the country in Massachusetts was going through this idea of a super predator, a young person who is just a horrible criminal, and so you are convicted when that is sort of the prevailing attitude. And then you're in prison, and you are eligible for parole because it's second degree, but there's something happening in Massachusetts at the time, which is when a parolee named Dominic Sinelli kills a Woburn police officer, and then Governor Deval Patrick fires the entire parole board, and nobody is released on parole. So, Jean, I'm wondering if we go to the parole question. This is a common thing for state lawmakers to react and get tough on crime when there's a big case like a Dominic Sinelli case in Woburn, and this affects all cases like Carter's after that. Does Massachusetts react in a unique way, or do most states do this?
Unfortunately, we don't react in a unique way. All states do this. But I would say a lot of people think that Massachusetts is more liberal on these issues than we actually are. When the parole rate in the state before the Dominic Cinelli case was a fairly healthy parole rate. I don't have it off the top, but it was in the 40-50%, certainly different for county prisoners than for lifers. Lifers would be a little bit lower than the whole mass of parole, but it was what would be considered a healthy rate of parole. After Dominic Cinelli and we had a new chair come in, there was essentially a ban. They decided not to even hear life or parole cases for a period of time while they were figuring things out, quote unquote. And the parole rate at that time dropped precipitously. And the problem with a parole rate dropping is that, number one, prisons are overcrowded. Number two, costs more money. Number three, it is not safer because more people come out of prison wrapping up their sentences instead of being on parole where they're supervised and supported by parole officers. So although it's counterintuitive, actually paroling people makes us safer. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but our parole rate has again returned, for lifers, has returned to a fairly abysmal rate, under 10%.
You're on lifetime parole now, right, Carter?
That is correct.
Yeah. Are you concerned that you could face any sort of backlash from going public with your story?
There's always a concern that people are not going to be as receptive to my experience and my story as obviously as I would want them to be and would hope that they would be. But I think for me, you know, you kind of have that scale, that balance that you have to weigh. And for me, it's more important to tell my story because my story is not that unique. There's, you know, more than 2.5 million people incarcerated across this country who have, they may not have all committed the same crime that I committed, and obviously the vast majority haven't, but the people that are incarcerated in this country have a similar story. They have a similar background. And it's not just the people who are affected directly by the criminal justice system, but all the people who are affected indirectly. You know, there's a couple of great quotes that kind of tell that story better than I can tell it about the importance of getting my story out there, which is the great quote from Frederick Douglass that it's easier to build strong children than to heal broken men, and a quote that's actually on the card that I hand out, which says, if we reform our schools, we will find little reform needed in our prisons. And for me, both of those amount to, we need to have systemic change from the earliest ages in our political, social, economic systems, and we need to have it in our social systems. And the greatest resource we have in all of our social systems are people. People like me who can take my experience, use it in a transformative way to transform myself, and then do what I can to give back. And so I consider it both a responsibility and an honor to be able to tell my story in the hopes that everyone hearing my story can learn from it.
Gene, by all accounts, Carter's story is a success story. Are we saying that the criminal justice system works with
no.
this story?
I think one of the things that I try to make clear in my book is that Carter and many others succeed in spite of things, not because of them. The numbers of juveniles who go to prisons, to adult prisons, and don't come out the way Carter came out is staggering. And statistics show us that if kids go to juvenile facilities, even though juvenile facilities have problems, still, nationally, statistics show that kids are more likely to get beaten up, they're more likely to get raped, they're more likely to be depressed and have mental health issues. They're more likely to have broken family relationships and less likely to get jobs. So all of the things that Carter has is working every minute of his life to achieve is not easy. I do believe there are many other kids who have come through the system who survive and make amazing things of their lives. I think it's important for us to hear those stories, but I don't think we can be deceived by the fact that this does not say that this is the norm.
All right. I want to thank both of you for coming in. Jean Trounstein is a professor at Middlesex Community College and author of the new book, Boy with a Knife, A Story of Murder, Remorse, and a Prisoner's Fight for Justice. Carter Reed is the subject of that book. He was released from prison in 2013. Jean, thank you.
Thank you.
Carter, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
The book, Boy with a Knife, was released in April. You can find more information about it at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. We had help today from Cassandra Sunt, Virginia Marshall, and Ashley Bailey. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Ati. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.